Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:35 British Summer Time. Today is September 18th, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. And really, it's been all action in a number of asset classes. This week in stock markets, we continue to see that the majority of markets pushed onwards to new recovery highs. They've been rallying now for the better part of 2 weeks, for most of September, in fact. And some of these indices are looking a little bit overstretched in the very short term. If we look a little bit further out, they've been rallying for the better part of 6 months, and this is a mature advance at this point. So while they're a little bit overextended in the short term, the progression of higher lows remains intact for the vast majority of these indices, and they really would need to be taken out before we could start to think about the onset of a deeper type reaction, which we take the shape of a reversion towards the mean for the majority of markets. In the bond markets, the majority of this week has been up one day, down the next, and we continue to see that treasuries are ranging in the region of the 120 level on the 30-year. And in bunds and gilts, they've pretty much been ranging, not going very much of anywhere for much of the month. This was also a rather interesting week in commodities because gold pushed up really rather strongly at the beginning of the week and gave up some of that advance in the last 2 days, but has held the gain above $1,000 admirably this week and is or continues to look like nothing more than a relatively consistent consolidation in the region of the prior high before this thing can sustain a move to new high ground. And if it can do that, then higher beta related markets like silver, platinum, palladium, and gold shares will all outperform on the upside in the that's the strongest likelihood at least. This was also an interesting week in the energy markets. The oil price continues to consolidate below the 75 level, and it's closing out the week in the region of $72. And natural gas has been quite volatile this week, but has pushed upwards over the last 10 days from approximately $2.50 to touch or to test the $4 level. And this has been a quite impressive short covering rally, and we're now into the first area of potential resistance. This is the progression of lower highs that's been in place since the peak last year. And while the downside has lost momentum when we look at the medium term, it really does need to sustain a move above $4 on the front month. And because you've got such a large contango, that's $5 on the second month, to really signal to us that demand is beginning to return in more convincing manner. In the rest of the commodity complex, soft commodities were quite firm earlier on in the week. They were a little bit easier in here today, and part of the reason for that is because the dollar has been stronger. But we saw that the grain markets had large upward dynamics. It was either late last week or early this week, and they haven't moved to new lows, but they haven't really improved upon that performance either. In the sugar market, we continue to see that it is ranging relatively close to its highs, and Arabica coffee has had a very powerful move this week, as has orange juice, and that is at least in part related to weather conditions in Brazil. The cocoa markets have also been really quite firm. So I said that the US dollar was a little bit stronger in here today, but certainly not in a dynamic fashion. The US dollar has been very weak over the last 10 days, since the beginning of September, in fact, and it is coming into an area of potential support against a range of currencies, and it is beginning to find a little bit of support, for example, in the area of 76 on the dollar index. But we haven't had anything in the way of upward dynamics. It's probably strongest against the UK pound, and that's probably more due to the pound weakness rather than any particular dollar strength. when we look at some of the stronger currencies relative to the dollar, such as the Australian dollar or the Canadian dollar, the New Zealand dollar, in fact, most commodity-related currencies, the dollar has firmed a little bit over the last half of this week, but not in a dynamic fashion, and certainly not enough to really question the integrity of its downtrend against these currencies. And really, just like with stock markets having to break their progressions of higher lows, the dollar would have to break its progression of lower rally highs before we could have any confidence that there was a meaningful dollar rally going or underway. What this week has also shown is that the pound has been down on consecutive days, particularly against the euro. And there has been speculation that the Bank of England will introduce negative deposit rates. I still think that that is an outside possibility. But we have renewed concerns about the banking sector and about the ability of the economy to recover from what really is a rather deep recession. And when compared to the way that France and Germany are beginning to emerge from the recessions that they have had, then the UK is coming off a little bit worse for wear in that comparison, and that is being played on by currency speculators. But the euro is now in a relatively consistent advance. It broke upwards back in July, consolidated the advance, and broke upwards again this week. So we have an uptrend in favor of the dollar, or sorry, in favor of the euro against the pound, and we would need downward dynamics to really question the momentum of this advance, and it would need to push back into the most recent range to really tell us that the consistency has changed. So it does look like we're going to see some further weakness for the pound because it's been weak against a whole range of currencies. With interest rates in the UK likely to stay very low for a prolonged period, and the same story in the US, and while the situation is somewhat better in Europe, they're not going to be in any rush to raise interest rates, and very much the same case in Japan. We have choices, or long investors have choices as to where they can pick up cheap credit, and they can invest it just about anywhere they like, and they can take on currency risk or not, because there is such a wide choice of areas that they can pick up cheap credit, and there is a large number, particularly of emerging markets and commodity markets, which have attracted increased levels of cash over the last 6 months in particular, as we've seen that the dollar in particular has got weaker, as has the pound recently. And the dollar certainly is the favorite of the funding currencies in here right now. We can talk in terms of a US carry trade, but it's probably more correct to regard it as a funding currency because there is big, deep capital markets in the US, and there are plenty of areas where cheap credit can be invested to gain a higher return or a better yield without having to invest abroad. But certainly, we're seeing that large numbers of investors are increasingly looking abroad for their investments, and that is certainly helping the outperformance of the Asian region and commodity-producing Latin America. When we look at what's happened in the US, particularly over the last 2 decades, and really since the NASDAQ bubble, that we had a phenomenal asset inflation in the late 90s, and the US dollar was also going up at the time, so it attracted the technology boom attracted money from all over the world because the US was leading the world in terms of its GDP growth and in terms of the technological advances that were taking place. And when that bubble burst, and following 9/11, the flow of credit into the market in order to support the economy in what was a very difficult time helped to spark a potentially even larger bubble or make even bigger credit problems for investors and for ordinary people over the subsequent years as cheap credit and easy lending standards and quite simply the avarice of the financial industry pushed house prices and the levels of credit and leverage in the market to unheard of levels, and we're now dealing with the aftermath again. And the temptation among central bankers, and they're certainly succumbing to it, is to flood the market with more liquidity in order to plug the holes that have been left in balance sheets with the collapse of the credit markets. And they've been falling over each other to tell us that they're going to keep this stimulus in the global economy for a while yet, and that is providing ample opportunity for leveraged investors to pick up credit on the cheap and to invest it in higher yielding assets. And we continue to see that that is providing the impetus for outperformance in the prime areas that a new bubble type scenario or asset price inflation could take hold. If we look at the US, we can see quite clearly that the potential areas where another bubble could develop are probably not really there. I certainly can't think of one. Whereas we can look at the rest of the world and say that there is ample opportunity for asset prices to increase in a number of emerging markets. Certainly in China, we have asset prices increasing right now, and in the commodity sector, it shows all the signs that we're looking for of recovery and new bull markets. And when we actually look for signs of bull markets, right across the boards in stock markets and in commodity markets, the leaders bottomed well in advance of the laggards. They formed bases first, broke upwards from their bases first, and have led in terms of absolute and relative performance since October. And that is at least in part because the majority of emerging markets, certainly those in Asia or in Latin America, didn't hold all of this subprime debt. They didn't hold exotic CDOs. They didn't need to. You look at a market like India or China, the banks there are more than well occupying their time with attempting to keep pace with economic growth without having to invent some nonsense instrument to con investors out of their money. And that is a trend that is likely to continue for a significant period of time. We're in the greatest urbanization in history, and that is a secular theme. It's got years left to run. With billions, quite literally, of new investors and new consumers entering the global economy, this type of massive increase in the consumers of goods hasn't happened before. And it is changing the dynamics of the global economy. As the per capita income of people, particularly in Asia, increases, so will their per capita consumption of raw materials. And we know for a fact that with such remarkably large young populations, that governments have no choice but to spend money today in order to build the cities, roads, houses, schools, sewage, power that these young people are going to need when they finish their education, find jobs, and start their own families. We've had a phenomenal baby boom in the emerging markets over the last 30 or 40 years. As per capita incomes increase, that baby boom is likely to decrease. But this is an extraordinarily long time frame, and in between, we're going to have a phenomenal bull market over the next decade and probably more in some of these emerging markets. The potential of young people to create value in an economy is well documented, and the consequent potential for capitalization in the related countries to of the related country stock markets to grow is also well documented. Now, there's obviously not a one-to-one correlation, and there might be time taken between the two, but there is phenomenal room for countries that are adopting sound economic policies and where governance is seen to be continuing to improve, that those countries are in a phenomenal position to benefit over the coming years from inward investment and a flight from the moribund conditions that we have in a number of developed economies. They have been able to flatter their economic performance over the last decade with an increase in credit, and it's going to take a long time before they can restructure themselves to, in such a way as to be able to really find themselves in any way able to compete with the increasing tendency that we have in places like China and India to be able to produce world-class companies that can compete with those well-established, longer existing companies in places like the USA and the UK and Germany. And that's a trend that's likely to continue. When we're looking for companies that are good long-term investments, then we need to be thinking about companies that have sound global franchises, that are selling the types of goods that will either help in the development of infrastructure for the great urbanization, or are the kinds of companies that will be able to benefit from the growing consumer base in those countries. Because those that have a particular focus on domestic economies in very slow growth areas are unlikely to be the better performers over the long term when we look at the global markets. And that is the foundation for the bull market in commodities. When we look at the bear market that preceded this bull market, it was 20, 30 years in the making. There were very long-term base formations where the industry was denuded of investors and people who knew about the industry, and the people that held on were, by their strict definition, they were survivors. And there was a certain amount of disbelief in the early stages of this bull market among those in the industry because they'd never lived through a bull market, at least not in their most recent memory. And we are now seeing that change. We're seeing more that miners are on the lookout to take each other over, and we're seeing sovereign wealth funds picking up resources in a large number of countries, particularly those companies that have been hit hardest by the credit crisis. And we're seeing that increasing numbers of investors are beginning to look around the world and think about the types of things they want to own in the next bull market, because they've been burned in property and they've been burned in technology in the last decade. And what we're also seeing is that a large number of investors who would have been investing back in 2003 and are still holding those shares probably have nothing to show for it. So we have a certain amount of disillusionment as well. But what we also can see is that we're getting a second bite at the cherry in the commodity complex. We've had a very large shakeout, and we've seen that some of the shares are already pushing up towards their highs. BHP Billiton, which really is the class act in the sector, is not that far off its all-time highs and has doubled since its low. And we've seen that while Rio Tinto has been slower to advance for probably no other reason than the fact that it is so highly geared and took on too much debt when it bought Alcan, but when we look around the rest of the sector, there is phenomenal potential for these shares to continue to advance, and the commodities are still well off their highs when we look at the industrial metals or indeed oil. Some of the soft commodities fell less, and those like sugar are really quite close to their highs. And cocoa, it also has, if we look at the 20-year chart, is well off its all-time high, but has a very consistent advance since the recent lows. So we're seeing that when you look at a broad index like the CRB, we see that it's in the middle of forming a first step above the base. Or if you look at the raw materials index, which has things that are more sensitive to economic recovery, then it has rallied very significantly over the last 6 months in particular. And this is all reflective of the fact that we've had a weak dollar on the one hand, and that has certainly helped to flatter commodity investments, but also the fact that whereas before there were a lot of people, before the crisis, there were a lot of people talking about the emerging markets as high beta. What we're now seeing is that there's an accepted reality now is that emerging markets are going to be the driver of economic growth in the coming years. And the slower growth economies of the USA and Europe are going to find it hard to keep pace. In terms of capitalization, they've got a very large lead, but in terms of economic growth, they are falling behind every year. And that is a trend that is likely to continue for a long time. With the amount of debt that is currently being taken on by sovereigns, we've already had a 20-year bull market in government bonds, and government bond yields hit an important low last year. The 10-year hit a low of 2%, having been in the late teens back in 1980 at the before Paul Volcker moved in and broke the back of inflation. And that's a very large move, and it was a massive secular advance in bond prices and decline in yields, but it's probably over. And the likelihood is that the low of 2% on government bond yields was probably the low. And with the amount of debt that not just the US, but just about every country in Europe is going to take on over the coming years, there's going to be no shortage of supply in bonds. And considering the fact that yields are so remarkably low, particularly if we factor in the fact that you have growth in emerging markets and between emerging markets recovering rather swiftly, then we see that commodities are appreciating in no uncertain terms, and they are most likely to be where inflation or inflationary pressures are first noticed. And you look at your 10-year yield, and you're not getting much more than about 3.25% for your 10-year investment. And that might have looked absolutely appealing when we had massive fears of deflation and stock markets were falling 5% a day. But when we've had 100% rally in a lot of stock markets since March, and when commodity prices are pushing upwards and economic growth is returning to the global economy, and you look around and you're saying, well, you're not really getting a whole pile of return on a relative basis for your 3.5 or 3.25%, and it's hard to make a bullish case for treasuries or indeed sovereign debt such as gilts or bunds. That doesn't mean that we're going to see the highs back in 1980 anytime soon. We could easily see base formation development, but the likelihood is that significant rallies in government bond prices are likely to be shorting opportunities for the foreseeable future. And it'll probably be the next type of recessionary environment before we see really good buying opportunities in these investments. What when we try to think about when is the next recession likely to unfold, well, the yield curve is at extraordinarily high spreads. And this spread hasn't been seen since the bottom down in 2003, and then you were back in the early 90s with the savings and loan crisis when the last time you saw this yield spread. So we know that for the moment, the monetary conditions available in the world are extraordinarily easy, and it's going to be a significant period of time before that spread contracts to an area where the yield curve might become inverted, and that really will be a signal to us that central banks are putting the foot on the brake in terms of stimulus, really quite emphatically. That's a reliable lead indicator that we might be a year away from the onset of a recessionary type environment. And the problem with such a long lead indicator is that one first identifies it. And with stock markets probably continuing to push to new highs, the temptation is to forget about it or to rationalize it. That's probably something that we'll have to worry about 4, 5, or 6 years from now. It's not something we need to worry about in the short term. More, what we need to worry about in the short term is the fact that this is a mature advance. We've been rallying now for the better part of 6 months, and some of the leading markets are a little bit overextended, particularly those that are pushing on to test their highs. So we're probably closer to the next medium-term correction type of environment, which is likely to take the form of a pullback towards the 200-day moving average for some of the leading markets, and for laggards, maybe a first step formation above the base. But most markets have now rallied to an extent that we can characterize them as bull markets, which suggests that even the possibility of base formation extension is probably the worst case scenario at this point. We're unlikely to see the majority of markets, and more importantly, globally significant markets, pushing down past their lows that were posted back in March. So for the S&P, that is probably in the area of $660 or 660 points. And since that's our worst case scenario, it suggests that in the longer term, we can use larger types of pullbacks as buying opportunities from an investment perspective. It's too early to be talking about exit strategies, although we are focusing our minds on that particular subject at the moment and thinking about the lessons that we've learned over the last year. The temptation, of course, is to focus on those lessons and apply the lessons we should have learned before the high to the next important type of high in the market, which is likely to be a very different thing. The highs that we saw in 2007 and 2008 were major trend reversals and led to something of a crash to a number of markets. What we're more likely to see the next time we have anything like a larger pullback is going to be a corrective phase within an overall bull market, and we're still in the early stages of this bull market. So we do need to concentrate on the lessons we've learned, but we need to be thinking about how we're going to apply those lessons a couple of years down the line and hopefully not have forgotten them at that stage, rather than wishing to do in the very early stages of the new cycle what we'd wished we'd done in the late stages of the last cycle. And I think I will leave you with that thought and wish all the best to all of you.